Spirit Radio Podcasts.
A lot of us groan when it comes to election time. We tend to shy away as Irish people from conflict and high emotion. But here's the question. While we expect our public representatives to make an effort, do we expect the same of ourselves? Since we have been given the right, thanks to the sacrifices of people who have gone before us, to have a say in who governs us, so on the line to share his thoughts on how to approach elections philosophically, we have writer and philosopher Dr. Mark Dooley. You're very welcome back to the show, Mark. How are you?
Thank you, Ronan. Delighted to be here again.
So first of all, Mark, do we appreciate enough the opportunity we have to vote, do you think?
No, we don't. You often recall in recent years, I presume a lot of your listeners do too, when the newly, in inverted commas now, I say it very circumspectly, the newly liberated countries of Afghanistan and Iraq were given the opportunity to vote. The elections were a sham and so forth and so on. But there was nothing as inspiring. One of the great motifs of the early part of this century was the purple finger of these people. They went, they dipped their finger in ink, purple ink, and then put it beside the candidate that they wanted elected. And that for them was a symbol of everything. You know, they were liberated, they were free, the tyranny was gone, they had a say in who governed them, and that meant that they had a renewed sense of hope and identity, which they couldn't have thought possible heretofore. And we, sitting here in the luxury of our Western societies, you know, some of us don't even bother to get out of bed on election day, which I think is an awful, you know, dereliction of democratic duty when you put it side by side with that example.
Yeah, you're right. And I one of the things that really stands out for me from those news reports from those two particular countries when they did have the democratic elections was they were, you know, round the block, whatever was left of the block, there were people queuing round the block in order to vote, weren't there?
That's quite correct. And there was no, they would queue for hours on it. They queue for days. In fact, you know, these elections went on 4 days because it was such a mammoth undertaking. I mean, general elections, any sort of elections, were not known in the country for decades. So to get your head around what was required here was a mammoth undertaking, of course, with international help. But it didn't stop people who had nothing going out and spending days under the hot sun to have a say in their future.
So, as you quite rightly say, there can be quite a lot of apathy and cynicism around elections. You know, and you know, I suppose we might ask if some of it's warranted, you know, given that many decisions today that affect our lives seem to be made over the heads, not just of us, but even of the very politicians that we're voting for.
Well, that is true. That is true. I mean, but that's a discussion about, I suppose, the European Union and, you know, how democratic is that? And I can understand, you know, people's apathy vis-a-vis that institution on the day that's in it, too,
given
what's happening across the pond and so forth. But however, I think there's something else here. We have only one say every 4 or 5 years to determine our future, to determine who governs us. Now, we don't always like the result, but that is the nature of democracy. We shrug our shoulders, we roll our eyes, and we say, right, we got to put up with it. And if the people that we want to be elected are elected, we cheer. And the others have to roll their eyes and shrug their shoulders. But that is the nature of compromise. And wouldn't you much prefer to live in a society that's governed by compromise than one that's ruled from the top down by a tyrant? So, you know, these are the questions that must exercise us as we approach elections. It may be a very superficial thing. Our vote may be, you know, 15 seconds long. But at least it counts.
Yeah, absolutely. We do talk about the responsibilities of our public representatives, but, you know, our responsibilities during election time, you know, I suppose, you know, people can say they're apathetic, but actually we kind of do have a responsibility to find out who's out there and what they stand for, don't we?
We certainly do. I mean, there's no point in complaining after the election is over about what politicians are doing or not doing if you did not, you know, take up the mantle and go out and vote on election day. Then you can rightly grumble. You can rightly hold them to account. You can rightly accost them on the doorstep the next time they come around looking for your vote. But if you do not vote, you have already given away that entitlement. You cannot hold them to account. Not in all good, you know, your morality, you can't do it, because you have, as I say, you have given away that entitlement. But if you get up and you go and you exercise this sovereign duty, I think. I think it's a sovereign duty. It's part of the covenant that we have with our politicians, that if we do our part, they should do their part. And if they don't do their part, then they're out next time.
Yeah.
It's a wonderful thing to be able to kick them out next time.
Yeah, it is. I mean, and it's very accountable in ways that many, many other people's jobs aren't. You know, it can be quite short-term.
Well, I'll tell you, Ronan, here's a little anecdote that will put it into perspective for you. I remember, and it is a perilous job. But yeah, believe you me, it's not a job for life. Most people say, oh, they get in, they stay in, and it's, you know, and politicians. But I remember one particular individual who shall remain nameless going into the Houses of Parliament for the first time. And he, I can give you away that much, phoned me or emailed me or something that evening and said, do you know, he said, the one and only thing I have heard discussed around the Oireachtas today, his first day, is how are we going to get elected next time?
Wow. First day.
First day.
Wow. That's amazing, isn't
he
it?
He was just delighted to be there.
Yeah, I know.
But that so, you know, the thing about it is, their lives are kind of on this knife edge. Every 5 years is rolling around very quick for a politician.
Yeah.
So they have to get what they have to do done, and it's up to them to perform. And if they perform, they stay. If they don't, out.
That's the end, yeah. You know, I was thinking about in terms of discussion, and it seemed, now I may be wrong about this, but it seems to me that when I was a kid, that people were quite free and able to discuss politics. Maybe I'm imagining that, but I very much feel there nowadays that people are kind of afraid to discuss politics because there can be a great toxicity. Maybe it's because things have become more polarized and people have gone to, you know, the opposite sides of each other. Should we discuss politics anyway, do you think?
Well, I certainly think we should. Oh, absolutely. I think, do you know, there's certain issues on the national agenda that stand as kind of silencing factors, you know. For one, same-sex marriage, abortion, all social issues, by the way,
sure.
Gender issues and so on. And these issues seem to have dominated the national conversation to the detriment of everything else. Things that are vital to our self-interest and our national interest, but nonetheless they'd be sidelined for this. Now, I did hear a conversation during the week where one person said to another, I think Leo Varadkar has been a fine Taoiseach, and the other person said, well, do you really? Tell me what he's done apart from these social issues. That's precisely it. That's all he needed to do, said the other person. He's moved the country away from that old Catholic Christian past, liberated us to go forward into the future. Now, therefore, if you're going to go into that terrain, you will encounter that level of toxicity, as you put it. However, there are other issues. Other issues, like the bread and butter issues, we used to call them, which are still there. I mean, taxation, our roads, our hospitals, our teachers, etc., 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 which we all have a vested interest in discussing and getting right.
Absolutely.
So it's about time we shifted back to that conversation.
Yeah. I was just thinking, even in terms of, you know, the Maslow's hierarchy of needs, it's like we've been up trying to have conversations about the very tippy top of that, and we haven't done the first two tiers.
Precisely.
You know, where do I live? Am I going to be on the street?
Precisely.
You know, that stuff. And
yes.
It's just,
and that stuff, of course, which, you know, is what exercises 99.9% of the population.
Yeah.
So, and by the way, it's very easy when you bring up a big social issue to distract and detract.
Well, yes, and
that.
And you would wonder if maybe there was a bit of that going on. But anyway, we can go back to that. Before you go, Mark, earlier this month, the respected philosopher Sir Roger Scruton died, and I know you knew him and you wrote about him. Can you tell us a little bit about him and his legacy?
Yes, he was I struggle to find an adjective to describe him. He was a polymath. He was a man of letters. He was the most intelligent man I have ever met. Of his 60 books, He wrote on a broad range of issues, music, architecture, sex, hunting, philosophy, politics, and so on. And his great contribution, I suppose, is to show that underlying the conservative vision of the world is not politics, but a philosophy. And a philosophy of belonging and settlement and home. Holding on to the things and conserving the things we love. Not for their own sake, but for the future generations. To show them how we've got from there to here. And that sense of belonging to a place that we can call home, that we can settle with the values and the customs which have been transmitted down the ages, I think is his greatest legacy. But, you know, I don't think anybody who is of a spiritual orientation in this day and age can afford to ignore him. I mean, his books, like the two in particular, The Face of God and The Soul of the World, try to show you how ordinary things like music, like architecture, like the environment, speak to us of spiritual things and sacred things. And when you look at the world that way, everything changes. So we buried him in Malmesbury last Friday, and what went down was a great man, but I think what has remained behind is this great vision, and it's not one that's going to go anywhere soon.
Yeah, he sounds like a wonderful man, a person I would have loved and very enjoyed to have met. If there was one of his books to read, what would you recommend?
Well, I would recommend one of my own, actually. I wrote three on him, okay. But the last one was called Conversations with Roger Scruton,
okay.
And it was published in 2016, and it goes through each facet of his... Well, we recorded it together over 3 days in his farm in Malmesbury. A farmer philosopher. He really acted out everything he believed. There was none, most thinkers sit in university ivory towers, but this man, everything he wrote about, he did. He wrote against communism. What did he do? In the 80s, he went into Czechoslovakia, smuggled in literature for people like, Vaclav Havel and so forth, who were the underground distance, was exiled, arrested, put into prison, beaten up, exiled from the country, but that didn't stop him. He then went to Poland, he went to Romania and forth and so on. So he really lived out the vision.
Yeah.
And but what I do in that book, in Conversations, is I take him through every facet of his life and his work, and we tease it out in a very kind of conversational, friendly tone. So I would go to Conversations with Roger Scruton, not only because it's a good book plug for me, but because it reveals the vision of a good life lived.
Well done. Philosopher and journalist Dr. Mark Dooley, thank you so much for talking
to
us.
Thank you, Ronan.
God bless you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Now, our next guest has been in something of a political wilderness since the heady days of government a decade ago. That period was overshadowed by the economic crash that swept away the Fianna Fáil Green Coalition. But since then, Eamon Ryan has become leader of the Greens, and with the growing significance of the environmental issue, his party is expected to do well in the next election and could well be an attractive coalition partner for whatever of the big parties garner the most seats. On the line to talk about the Green Party's approach to these elections, we have its leader, Dublin-based South TD, Eamon Ryan. You're very welcome to the show, Eamon. How are you?
Thank you, Ron. Good morning.
Yeah. First of all, Eamon, junior coalition partners, I mean, you know better than anyone. They do tend to get blamed for everything. Would you do it again?
Yeah, because, to be honest, you're not in it for your own, like, it's not a career choice. You're there because you believe, the country should go in a certain direction, and one of the ways you can help that is through government. And it's not easy, but it can also be rewarding in terms of working with the public service, working with other parties, working for all the people of the country. If you're standing for election and if you believe in the constitutional democratic republic we have, as I do, well, then I think it behoves you to kind of do your best, see what you can do, and that may not guarantee you holding your seat, but that's not the reason you're in politics, I think, for the first place. So my experience, it was challenging, particularly the time we were in government, but you could get things done, and I think particularly when the sort of issue that I really work a lot on, the whole issue about climate and biodiversity loss, this next decade is critical, and I believe the solutions are going to be good for our society as well as being good for the environment. So
yeah, there's no doubt. Like you don't go into politics not to govern. It's the ultimate, isn't it? And I take your point. The concerns over climate change, it's just literally flown up the agenda. Really, I mean, it's a very positive thing in a lot of ways. Looking at it now, obviously the door is open in terms of public opinion to a lot of things that would have been difficult to have gotten over the line really maybe 10 years ago. Is there anything that you think maybe as a Green Party might do differently this time?
I think the whole environmental movement has learned a lesson in a way of the last 20, 30 years. Like, I think for too long we were kind of maybe thinking, well, if we could get the individuals to change their behaviour, you know, that would be the best approach. And to be honest, I think that didn't work because, well, firstly, it's making people feel guilty and you're kind of, and you're comparing, you know, this massive big global problem and you're asking, you know, have you changed your light bulbs or whatever?
Yeah.
So I do think it needs to be system change where it's easier for us to do the right thing and I think tackle the problem at source. So the basic response is we have to stop using fossil fuels and then that translates down. I mean, I don't think it's my job to be out now telling people, you know, that climate change is real or so on. They can see that when they see in the news the bushfires in Australia, and I could go on.
Sure.
Our job is to show how taking this path actually leads to a better way. If you switch to public transport, walking and cycling, I think it'll create a better local environment for everyone. If we really make our homes warm and properly insulated and have their own power supply, solar panels on the roof, it just makes better homes. If we start farming in a way which is more respectful of nature, it's not only that it's kind of doing its bit for the environment, but it actually, I think, is a better long-term future for Irish farming. So it's those sort of, I think the environmental movement has learned a lesson that really what we need to do is make it easier to make those switches and to provide the incentives to help people switch rather than just kind of putting it all down to individual behaviour.
Yeah, that's a very good point because I think, you know, people do get a little bit feeling of the powerlessness that can come about when you're trying really hard to do, and I know this from my own experience because I would be quite environmentally, it would have always been, and you'd be trying to do the right thing and then every so often you'd be going, but then there's China, you know, then there's India, you know what I mean? So the idea that there's people working on a global level to trying to make it better too can be really good and encouraging for the individual trying to do the small things.
Yeah, there was Blind Boy from the Rubber Bandits, you know, from the guy with the plastic bag in his head, was on The Late Late a few months ago, and I think he put it really well. He said, people, if we get obsessed and that, you know, what's the size of our footprint, carbon footprint compared to China? And he said, yeah, but do you know what? We also have a cultural footprint, and actually there's a story. If Ireland turns green in this way, it kind of sends a signal out to the world that actually it's doable and it can be done in a way that you don't leave people behind. And I think as well, then, just back to the very local level, I think you're kind of improving our local environment in terms of restoring nature, restoring wildlife, creating a kind of an urban environment which has clean air, which maybe allows people, you know, just to build a sense of community. That's a positive in its own regard. And I think people do, when you bring it back home like that, to think, how do we improve our own area, community? That's the way to address it rather than having to kind of carry the whole world on our shoulders. There's an old adage in green thinking, kind of think global but act local.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. The last time the Greens were in government, you phased out incandescent light bulbs. Do you think there are any quick wins that could be implemented immediately, say, if you were in government, that you could do very fast?
Let me think. I still think one of the quickest wins is where you do kind of, you set building standards. Like, you know, so you kind of say, okay, this is the way we do it, and we could still improve further, I think, the way we do building.
Right.
I suppose one of the most immediate, and I'm thinking of Dublin very much here, and maybe I'm showing my own colours here because I've been a transport campaigner for 30 years. I was originally chairman of the Dublin Cycling Campaign 30 years ago.
I remember that, yeah.
And I do think Dublin is just, we have this Bus Connects project coming up, and people will know about that. It's been in public consultation for the last year. And it was very controversial when it came out first, and I think rightly so, because the National Transport Authority was saying, what we're going to do is we'll run four lanes along all the kind of main approach roads in and out of Dublin. And people often, they were going through local communities, local villages, residential streets, and it meant maybe that the trees were going to be taken out or the front gardens would be taken out. And I think in fairness to the National Transport Authority, they listened to that concern and the basic point that we want to live in communities, not transport corridors. And they've come back with revised plans that I think are actually much better in the right direction. And it will now require some restriction to traffic, you know, when car traffic. So if you're coming up to a bus stop, or sorry, a traffic light, it'll be designed in a way that the bus always gets first, that it gets ahead of the cars and gets through so that the bus speeds improve. And in some instances, it'll be making, you know, kind of reducing the number of car lanes, maybe creating one-way streets rather than two-ways on every occasion. And that'll also create the safe space to make it easy, safer to cycle in the city. And I think that actually is probably, I mean, it's not immediate, but it's probably a 2 or 3 year project that the decision has to be made the next year. And I suppose I'm going back to my roots here now, but I don't see any reason Dublin shouldn't be like somewhere like Copenhagen or Amsterdam. I don't know if you've ever been in those cities.
Of course, yeah, yeah.
But where it's just thousands of bikes
yeah.
And the more bikes there are, the safer it becomes, because it's just a cultural change. You see that as the everyday way. And because Dublin's flat, it's actually relatively dry. It's drier than Amsterdam or Copenhagen. And the distances aren't that long, although they're getting longer. That's my kind of, if I was saying the one thing that really could turn things around the next 2 or 3 years, that's probably one of my
big ones. Yeah. You actually mentioned this kind of in passing earlier on, but you know, it's just one of the things that I find, particularly in the environmental debate, that it's not just enough to be environmental. You know, you have to be the right sort of environmental, you know, and I feel like the debate is becoming a bit partisan, and sometimes there's a little bit more shaming than consensus building. Have you been kind of picking up on that?
Yeah, and I fight against it because I don't think it'll work. Like, the scale of the change is so great that if we do this as a divisive thing, if we do it as a divisive urban-rural or young versus old or left versus right, that way won't work. That way brings you to what, you know, what's happening in America or Australia at the moment, where kind of environmental politics is seen as a divisive issue. And one of the things I've been saying consistently this election is we'll work with all parties, and we want to make this something that belongs to everyone, because in that way, the more people on board, the easier it is going to be for us to make the leap. So that lends me towards, you start by listening, you ask people for help rather than telling them what to do. You admit you don't know everything, but you want to learn by doing, and we will gain by learning by doing, because this is where the new economy is coming. And I mean, you still have all your conviction and still all of the sense of urgency, but sometimes you get there quicker if you do it in that sort of collaborative way rather than just to batter someone into submission, because in my experience, that doesn't often work too fast.
Yeah, and it just makes everybody resentful and hateful. they don't want to go your way, even though they might be agreeing with you. To take another line here for a second, Eamon, you know, abortion was introduced into Ireland during the last Dáil, and we talked to Pat or Tobin last week of Aintu, who said, look, if his was in the government, he would be able to, or at least looking to repropose the various humanitarian amendments to the abortion legislation, you know, things like the protection of the conscience rights of the medical professions, or even the pain relief to give to the baby in late-term abortions. Would you stand in the way of those kinds of amendments if you were in coalition?
I'd listen to what Pat has to say. I work with them and get on well with them. I think we'd find common cause in terms of trying to reduce the need or the number, and looking at ways that you can support all our people, particularly people who are pregnant. But I think we've had a referendum. The decision was made, and the fundamental approach has been agreed. So I don't see the Oireachtas necessarily going back and kind of reopening that. So I think the more important, my focus would be, how do you support young people so that they can raise children in this country? Increasingly it's difficult because people can't afford a rent. People can't, you know, there's no certainty. People are, it's later and later before they get to even leave home. And I think our whole structures at the moment are making it really difficult for young people in Ireland. And I think that should be our primary focus. How do we make it easier for people to kind of set out their lives and raise a family in a way that works?
Yeah, absolutely. We've a little text in from Paul here. He says, please ask Eamon how he seriously expects Catholics / some Christians that he knows how to save the planet and at the same time kill the unborn. Heavy question for you.
Yeah, can I go back on the first part? I suppose I do think, I mean, I was inspired very much by the Laudato Si encyclical, which Pope Francis wrote 4 or 5 years ago, was it now? And I think That was a hugely significant document in terms of widening our understanding of what the role and purpose and mission of the church is in the modern world. And I think that's something that I think I find a lot of people are inspired by, and I think it is something that is very important in terms of how we approach this. If you just come at it as a kind of technocratic or an economic analysis, you're missing the bigger picture.
Sure.
That we are looking to protect nature because we're connected to nature and we're connected to each other in a way that's, I suppose, that's the ecological approach, is seeing how everything's connected.
Yeah.
That does inspire me and it guides what I do.
So I know this is, we were supposed to be talking about your manifesto, so I want to get to it before I let you go. Look, it's very far-ranging and it's really interesting. I mean, you've got universal basic income in there, you've got free public transport for students, light rail systems for Cork and Galway, and we're a nationwide station, so there'll be people listening in from all over. Significant changes to energy generation. So to me, anyway, it looks mostly really quite good. But how many of these policies do you think you could implement in a coalition government?
I think a lot, because I think the other parties are saying that they agree and that they want to address this, but what they're not, they're kind of saying that on the one hand, and they're saying, well, we'll stick to the status quo in so many other ways, in how we move around, how we look after our land. And I think the challenge is clear. The European Union is saying we have to at least have a 50% reduction in emissions within the next 10 years. Now, we're starting from a bad place because we haven't done anything in the last 9 years, so we've probably got a bigger leap than other countries. But I think it behoves every party in coalition arrangements to sit down and set out how exactly would we achieve that sort of 7% per annum reduction, which would get you to that target. The current Gala Government Climate Action Plan only shows a 2% reduction per annum. So how do we have a threefold increase in ambition? And in any talks for government and in any kind of approach to that, you have to have, I think that would be probably one of the central focus. We tend to agree on issues like, you know, introducing sláinte care. That's something that there's broad agreement on. We tend to agree on, you know, everyone's pretty much saying, yeah, the key to the housing solution is, housing problem is increasing supply. Where there isn't agreement is in this core, a bigger, wider crisis that we're facing. And I think it would take several weeks and it would take a lot of talk, but I don't see it as impossible, because ignoring it and saying, well, we won't be ambitious, that road leads to potentially very large fines, up to €7 billion by the end of this decade, possibly. And I prefer to spend that money now being ambitious. And I think the other parties say they agree with that. Well, then I'm confident if we sat down, we could make the leap, and we would do it in a way that pulls a whole ranges of our society together. And it won't work unless it's a better outcome. It has a social justice
dimension,
return, as an environmental one.
One last quick text in from Stephen in Kilkenny. He's a farmer in Kilkenny, right? Is the Green Party aware of regenerative agriculture and holistic planned grazing management?
Yeah, and I think that sort of approaches are absolutely central. I think there's a whole range of things happening where we really start focusing back on how we restore and maintain the life and quality of our soils. And that also we engage in farming, which starts to restore. I mean, we've lost 30 years ago, we had about 500 rivers, which were described as being in pristine water quality, and that's fallen to 20 in the last 30 years. And that sort of regenerative agriculture methods, not only is it very beneficial in terms of climate and in terms of animal welfare, but it's also, it helps address those underlying key core problems. How do we protect and nourish our soils? How do we protect water and air quality? And that's why I'd be very supportive of those sort of approaches.
Okay, I'm sorry for keeping you so long, but they started coming in there. So Eamon Ryan, Dublin Bay South TD and leader of the Green Party, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Leon.
God bless you. Now, an upcoming TV show is looking to help singletons living in rural Ireland to find love, romance and companionship. So if you're a farmer or a single person living in rural Ireland and finding it difficult to find romance, you may want to consider applying to take part in this TV show called Love in the Countryside. On the line now to tell us more, we have its casting producer, Leah Wallace. You're very welcome to the show, Leah. How are you?
I'm good, Ron, and thanks, Emil.
Great. First of all, Leah, this upcoming TV show is run by Kite Entertainment, my old friend Darren, who has produced some of Ireland's most popular shows, such as Gogglebox Ireland, Ireland's Got Talent, and Ireland's Fittest Family. So how did the idea for this show come about?
Well, I guess nowadays, from doing research calls with a lot of single people, that dating apps just seem to be not the way forward anymore. And especially then talking to people over the years of other programmes who are living in rural Ireland, they find it even tougher to meet people, even in a companionship or a friendship kind of way. You know, if they're quite isolated or due to work commitments, they just have no time. And then dating apps don't work because there's only so many people you can swipe right or left. So there's just nowhere for people to meet people anymore. And due to work commitments, as I said, Ronan, they just don't have the time.
And it's quite interesting. I do remember, even when, you know, even if you have a work commitment, if you're involved in the farm, my goodness, that can be really very, very intense. But even when they do, it's amazing. You go to a pub and everybody's in their phone.
Well, that's it, yeah. And people are not really communicating as well, you know. And I've been on the road now for the past couple of weeks chatting to so many people, farmers and just people who are living in remote areas like Achill Island or Valentia Island in Kerry. And the communication skills are just not there anymore. But from my research, people really do want to connect more. And people are lonely. You know, it's isolating out there, especially in the west of Ireland, and people are saying it's forgotten about now. So I guess we just want to bring a bit of romance into people's lives now.
Brilliant. So what way is the show going to work, Leah?
So basically, at the moment, what I'm doing is, as a casting producer, I'm looking to talk to people who are living in rural Ireland. And these people have to be committed to the land. So be it coming from a farming background, fishing background, or just, as I said, someone who's living in a remote area, but they just can't pack up and leave, you know, because of the commitment they have to the area they're living in. So I want to chat with them. We'll set up a dating profile for them, and people can get in touch with us if they want to date these people, and we'll go from there then.
Wow, that's very interesting. So it's a kind of dating show, really.
Yeah, well, that's it. You know, we're bringing back a bit of old romance. You know, people can contact these lovely people, be it writing a letter, a love letter maybe, rather than just swiping on your phone, you know.
So you're basically screening, really, is what you're doing. You're going out meeting people face to face.
Yeah, that's it. And I want to really hammer home that we're looking for all ages, you know. We particularly want to look for people who are a bit more mature, who maybe have never found romance, or else it's the second time around, you know. Maybe divorced or separated, or it just hasn't happened for them. So I definitely want to talk to people who are in their 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, and, you know, upwards, you name it. This is not Love Island. We're not looking for the 18 to 21 year olds who just want to be on TV. We definitely want to chat to people who really want to meet someone and are just struggling because of where they live or due to their work commitment.
Absolutely. So how do they make contact with you?
So if they can email me, countrylove@kiteentertainment.com. So even if they just want to drop their name and their telephone number, and I'll get back in touch with them. Myself, my colleagues will be in touch straight away.
And you're going to go and have conversations with them if you feel like they've got good potential for the show, and you screen them so that other people don't have to.
Absolutely, yeah. We're doing all the hard work for them. Well, we know that these people are busy, so this is what we're trying to do. Take all that pressure off them. So, as I said, all ages, you know, anyone who's listening who thinks they're just too old to find love, that is not the case. I don't want to hear of it.
And when is it slated for broadcast for TX?
It'll be later this year. So there's a few things still under wraps, and maybe I can get back on your show and ask for more information.
No, that'd be absolutely brilliant, Leah. We'd love that. So it's countrylove@kiteentertainment.com. And now you've heard Leah speaking, and she's lovely. So don't be afraid.
I'm really nice, and I genuinely want people to meet nice people. So.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's really good. And thanks, Leah. Thanks for taking the time. Give our best to Darren in there. And,
I will.
We'll hopefully talk to you later on the year.
Yeah. Definitely, I'd love to come back on and tell you how we're getting on.
Great, God bless you. We'll see you soon.
Thanks, Emil. Bye
now.
Thank you.
Bye. Have you ever considered what positive contribution your garden has on the environment, no matter how big or small the garden? In studio now to chat to us about the role of our gardens and how we can help with climate change with our green spaces, we have Anne-Marie Bowring from the Dorky Garden School. You're very welcome back to the show, Anne-Marie. How are you?
Good morning, and terrific.
Good.
Beautiful day.
It's gorgeous out there. And kind of mild, isn't it? It's springy.
Kind of mild. It's according to my car, I just came from Dorky, obviously, a minute ago, and it was 14.5 degrees. That's incredible. But you know, it can't snow still, you know.
That's right. as the old farmers up in Roundwood always say, February, February's the one you got to be careful about. You
absolutely
know?
But I mean, that's the interesting thing, because for quite a few years we had mild winters,
and
mild summers, and people started planting plants in their gardens. I think one of the big things was tree ferns became very popular, which are beautiful plants, and they were planted in really, really lovely locations, etc., and suddenly we had this massive snow and they all died.
Yeah.
So, you know, we think, you know, we're talking about climate change and, you know, our plants and our gardens and things dying and not being able to cope with the changes. We get tricked into thinking that everything is mild and we can plant this and plant that. But we can't. We have to work and with nature, with what the environment wants. Because weather, climate is what we have and weather is what we get.
Yes.
Isn't that what they say?
Exactly.
You know?
And you know, I'm just going back to where I'm from or where I live. We had snow that stayed for 3 weeks, three foot deep in 2009, for 4 weeks at the end of 2010. Remember the Beast from the East?
Yes.
I mean, that was literally up the height of the door. We opened the door and there was just an imprint of the door.
It was such
snow.
Fun, wasn't it?
It was just like, put everything in the garden. Yeah. 2009, 2010, everything died.
Yeah.
Now we've got it sorted so that we don't.
Well, but, you see, plants that are long-lived, that have really deep roots. I always remember seeing my friend's garden in Galway and they had a massive big gristlinia hedge, which is this evergreen hedge. It was very, very old.
Yeah.
And it was totally destroyed.
No.
But it was a well-established plant, and they left it, and it's totally regrown.
Wow, that's amazing.
You know, so that's what happened then.
Wow. Can you chat to us a little bit more in detail about how our gardens play a valuable role in helping the environment? Like, I mean, climate change, biodiversity loss, all that sort of thing.
Massive role. The RHSI and the RHS in the UK have done research on this a couple of years ago. I remember reading an article about it. And we're becoming much more of an urban society, as we know, even in Ireland. And especially in the UK, there are large, you know, Manchester, London, all these big cities. There are, millions of people living in them. And each individual garden has a job to play. From the point of view of biodiversity, people are talking about biodiversity all the time now, which is just basically a jungle full of different types of plants, different types of flowers, different types of everything growing in spaces. And with that, with biodiversity, you're feeding the soil with biodiverse plants who are giving off different signals to the soil. They're feeding all, so if you're constantly eating the same food all the time, even though it's really, really good food, after a while your body starts craving for something else.
Yeah.
And it's the same with the gardens, but the urban gardens have a huge part to play with the environment and what they offer, because we were very conscious of the soil and how it matters. I was looking at an old gardening book the other day, and it was talking about spreading some sort of chemical or potash thing on the lawn to get rid of worms.
Yeah.
What? You know, we have a heart attack. The reason why people don't like worms.
Why would you do that?
Well, in this time of year, if you go out, you'll find there are little brown patches in your garden soil lifted up. And that's basically the worms pushing up the soil.
Yeah.
And what they're doing is aerating the soil, of course.
Yeah.
They're putting it allowing air. We absolutely need them.
Yeah.
You know, and even our lawns, for example, you know, it's lovely to have a lovely, perfect, all green lawn. But when you have an all green lawn, you have what they call a monoculture. You have probably maybe one or two different types of grasses, but that's it. Whereas in a lawn that is allowed to have a few daisies in it, a few dandelions, a few this, that and the other, speedwell or whatever it is, that's a biodiverse lawn. And, you know, even the moss can be a bit of a nuisance. You mightn't like it, but it has a place.
Does it?
Absolutely.
Tell me, because we're effectively like, we're on a bog, really. You know, I mean, it's like just this oasis that just keeps feeding water up and up and up. So sometimes I go out and go, I really, if I was to cut this, and we do cut it regularly, but sometimes you feel like you're cutting moss rather than actual grass.
Well, you can be.
Yeah.
But I mean, you really have to try and work with what you have.
Sure.
And what we're all the time trying to do in our gardens is manipulate nature.
Yeah.
You know, we're trying to create something.
So
you know,
what does moss do?
Moss basically it's a covering.
It protects
the soil. But what it's most importantly doing when it's green, everything that's green is photosynthesizing, which means it's absorbing the sun's
It's lovely and green.
Energy.
That's good.
It is, but it's feeding the soil as well. And if we didn't have photosynthesis, if we didn't have the sunlight, we wouldn't have our lovely green. We wouldn't have our oxygen.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. It's very, very important. So the more green you have in your garden, the better. And, you know, it's lovely to have some bare soil. I like looking at bare soil, when, especially when it's nice and healthy looking.
Yeah,
but right. Really, 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 you should try and cover it as much as possible with plants.
And can I ask, we have spoken about this before, but the idea of using, you know, when you're, you know, kind of using weed killer or using whatever it is, that to try and use natural products, you know, and then even when we're trying to, you know, I suppose we're trying to fertilize the soil.
At this time of the year, it's a good time to dig out perennial weeds that you have growing in your beds.
Yeah.
You know, you won't be able to take them all out. But I mean, and yet again, dandelions are a fantastic source of nectar, pollen.
Oh, okay.
For bees at the beginning of the season.
Yeah.
So it's about a mix of everything. If on a dry day, again, if you have weeds on a path or a gravel path or anything like that, go out with your hoe. I always use an oscillating hoe.
Tell us, what is that?
And it's kind of a stirrup type hoe.
Okay.
And it literally takes the tops off the plants. And then the plants will then biodegrade, they'll break down, and they'll feed the soil.
Sorry, I'm absolutely fascinated by this oscillating hoe thing. So what is it? Does it come back and forth or something?
It does, it swivels. It literally just goes, along the top of the soil or the
gravel. And kind of goes back and
forth. And just cuts the top off the weeds that you don't want. Now, weeds are, flowers can be weeds too, you know.
Sure.
A weed is a plant growing in the wrong place.
Yeah.
So if you don't want something growing in the wrong place, that's a weed.
Yeah.
Now, the reason why we get rid of some weeds in our gardens is because they can be toxic to, they can bring in disease which we don't want in our garden.
Yeah.
But you know what? If you're constantly sort of minding your garden, I would never use a chemical weed killer.
Right.
Because there's no need for it.
Okay.
Okay, there's absolutely no need for it.
So what do you do in that case?
What do? I just feed my garden. I feed it with manure or compost or anything I can get really that's organic.
Gotcha.
Organic means something that was living.
Yeah.
All right, that's what organic means. And then, you know, therefore natural clean living is what you want. And by doing that, you're feeding the soil, you're feeding all the grubs. And then people talk about, oh, I have slugs in my garden. Yes, you'll have slugs in your garden if you have no nature in your garden.
Oh.
You know,
right.
If, you know, you will have slugs. And after a while, a balance comes and the slugs will go on someplace else. Slugs are very important creatures in our garden.
So what are slugs a sign of then?
There is a sign that you have a lot of organic matter there, which is good.
Which needs to be eaten up.
Yeah. The problem is that quite often if you have little tiny plants and they're seedlings and you're afraid of this quite often slugs can damage them. But quite often, you might have sacrificial plants and they won't get everything.
Yeah.
So I don't have a problem with slugs in my garden and I hope I have a hedgehog in my garden because I know if I have a hedgehog in my garden, I certainly won't have any slugs.
Slugs, yeah.
But the problem with urban gardens now sometimes is that there are highly fenced, highly walled back gardens and there's no gap for these creatures to pass through because they need to be able to walk, you know.
Yeah.
They don't understand. They're living in our space and we're living in their space.
Their space, exactly.
You know?
Yeah.
And even foxes, the urban fox definitely has a place. Mind you, when it eats my chickens, I'm not really that happy about it.
I can imagine.
But their primary food, believe it or not, is grubs and worms and things like that in the soil. They like to dig.
Wow.
You know, and of course, they're creatures that will, if there's something there, if there's something nice for them to eat, and
they'll eat it, basically.
They'll eat it, yeah. And it's easy.
So it's been unusually warm, as you were saying, winter. Mm. Do you think that's going to impact plants and flowers this season?
Well, what can happen sometimes is that, you know, trees can go into flower a bit earlier,
exactly,
especially apple trees, fruit trees. And the problem with that is then we can have a late frost and that could damage the harvest for the following year. Plum trees, for example, flower very early, so there's always a danger of that. But you can, if you have one plum tree, you can protect it from frost. You can put a mesh over it or a fleece over it. That's the best way of putting it.
Right.
You know, if you're afraid. Now, Ireland is a very interesting country, as we know.
Mm.
And when we were always told it's saucer shaped, right? Which means that we have saucer shaped. So, yeah, okay, right, it's fine. It means that we have higher bits around the sides and it's lower in the middle. But that means then that the Midlands are much colder than the other areas because it's lower down and the cold air collects, so therefore it's going to be a bit colder there. So, but I mean, you garden according to your climate, and that's very important.
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely. So you basically you cut your cloth to suit your whatever.
Absolutely, right plant, right place.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah. So, any workshops coming up?
Yeah. Well, actually, I'm having a willow weaving workshop tomorrow.
Wow.
Yeah, I absolutely adore willow.
Yeah.
It grows wild in our ditches.
Yeah.
I was going to say what you know. It's medicinally. It was one of the first to. What's the word I'm looking for? They took the chemical out of willow
yeah.
and they used it for a certain product. Do you have any idea what it is?
I'm going to say, is it painkiller? No.
A type of painkiller. Well done.
Is it aspirin? No.
Yes, it is aspirin.
Is it aspirin?
Yeah.
Okay.
Salicylic acid or something like that it's called.
Okay.
And then traditionally people would chew it if they had a toothache or something like that.
Chew the willow.
Wow. Yeah. So I don't, I, you know, I
amazing.
You know, so it is.
So like you're talking about like Stone Age man?
That's
bark.
Even less than that. I got addicted to Anna. I'm with an E on, Anna Griggins.
That was really good series, wasn't it?
And they actually had an Indian family came in, or a native family, and a boy fell, and they immediately gave him some willow.
Right.
To chew for the pain.
Wow.
So I thought, oh my God, this is great.
haven't seen the latest edition of it, but it's a real good family thing to watch.
Oh, I love it. But also their farming is just amazing, just to watch how they lived.
So just to explain, the workshop is tomorrow
morning at 10.
And in your place?
In my place.
Great,
and I have four people coming, and if somebody else wants to join us, they're very welcome.
How do they make contact with you?
Well, on my website is easy, because my details are there, www.dockygardenschool.com.
Brilliant.
So all my information is there, my phone number, etc. And give me
fantastic.
A call. That's the best thing to do. Also the RHSI.
Yeah.
Tomorrow afternoon they're having a talk in Leeson Park in what's the name of the place?
Is it Wesley Hall there?
At half past two, and that'll be a very interesting talk on the garden in spring opening up.
Right.
Who's giving it? Robert. I have it here. I'm terrible for remembering names, and I'm going to be there myself tomorrow afternoon.
Great.
Because I'm an avid member of obviously the.
My goodness,
RHSI.
You're having a very very busy day tomorrow. So you're doing the willow workshop in the morning, are you?
Morning, I'm doing that.
And what time in the morning is that?
That's on at 10.
10 in the morning,
and then spring into action at Wesley House. That's what it's called, and with Morris Parkinson, he's a fantastic, knowledgeable fellow.
And finally, February 22nd.
22nd, I'm having I'm just doing one morning workshop on designing a potager, which is just designing a sort of an ornamental vegetable garden.
Oh.
Well, which is flowers, obviously, and plants, and the combination of them.
Lovely.
And that's another thing, too, is that, you know, plants working together help each other.
Lovely.
You know, like us all, we need each other.
And that's in Dorky Garden
that's
School
in
as well.
That's in Garden School.
So the February the 22nd. So February 1st, February 22nd.
www.dorkygardenschool.com. Lovely morning.
Great. Anne-Marie Bowring.
Thank you.
Founder of Dorky Garden School. Thank you so much for talking to us this morning. God bless you.
Thanks for listening to our Spirit Radio podcast. Don't miss out. Subscribe today. Find out how at spiritradio.ie.